This is Edwin Newman inviting you to a special 55-minute edition of Meet the Press with the five new Republican senators sworn in on Tuesday. Our guests are Senators Charles H. Percy of Illinois, Howard H. Baker Jr. of Tennessee, Edward W. Brook of Massachusetts, Cliff Hansen of Wyoming, and Mark O. Hatfield of Oregon. On our panel of reporters today are Lawrence E. Spivak, permanent member of the Meet the Press panel, Jack Bell of the Associated Press, David Broder of the Washington Post, and Nancy Dickerson of NBC News. We'll have the first questions now from Mr. Spivak.
Senator Percy, Utah Secretary General of the UN said the other day that he believes there will be no move towards peace so long as the bombing of North Vietnam is going on. Are you in favor of stopping the bombing of North Vietnam unilaterally?
No, I am not. We know that during the two-day pause, the North Vietnamese just continued supplying the South Vietnamese. We could not give up that bombing without a quid pro quo, and that gives us the opportunity to bargain.
Senator Baker, where do you stand on that issue?
Mr. Spivak, I agree. I think we must not discontinue bombing on a unilateral basis. I think, after all, we're all concerned with the unpleasantness of war and the hideous aspects of the bombing of North Vietnam and the attendant occasional civilian casualties. But this is the price you pay for determination, and determination we must have in order to convince the communists that they will not be permitted to win in their aggressive effort in Vietnam.
Senator Brook, would you, under any circumstances, stop the bombing unilaterally?
Mr. Spivak, if cessation of the bombing would bring about peace in Vietnam, I would favor cessation of the bombings. I don't believe that the bombings in the North have served the purpose for which they were intended. The infiltration of the North Vietnamese into South Vietnam is continuing. And obviously we have not driven the Viet Cong in Hanoi to the conference table. I think we certainly should at this time reassess the bombings, reevaluate the bombings to make a determination as to whether the advantages of bombing outweigh the disadvantages.
You then at this time favor stopping the bombing since you don't know what it would or would not do?
I favor reevaluation. I think that this is a determination the State Department must make, but certainly if it is the key to bringing about peace, then we should reassess and do it immediately. And it would appear that it is the key, not only from what is said by Utant and by Southeast and Eastern Asia and by the Soviet Union, but obviously this seems to be the one thing that is holding up a negotiated peace.
Senator Hansen, what would you do?
I am in full support of the generals, the commanders in the field in Vietnam. I think that they have good and sufficient reasons for feeling that the best interests of this country and of peace will be served by the bombings. I support them 100%. I was over there a little more than a year ago, and I think that too many decisions have been made in the past for political reasons, and too little credence has been given to the commanders in the field and in the military, and I support the bombings.
Senator Hatfield, I believe at one time you were for the cessation of the bombing. Are you still?
I am. I think we have to consider the bombing in context with our total policy and not isolate it from the rest of our actions on the diplomatic as well as on the military front. And I think when you look at the balance sheet, you will find that we have not achieved a great deal of military success by the bombing program. We have alienated the rest of the world. We have not advanced our military cause, and I believe that when you look at the loss we have had in manpower and in planes, and the fact that they have hardened their position, both through infiltration, as Senator Brook has said, and other actions, the bombing policy has not proved successful. So I ask the question, why continue it?
Senator Percy, I think you are one of those who feels that it's absolutely essential for the Republican Party to unify itself. Is this a fair sample of the unity that the Republican Party is going to show in the coming Senate?
I think we have a basis of agreement here, but some shadings of difference. I have always maintained for the past year that the bombings have not accomplished the stated purposes of this administration, that is, stopping infiltration and weakening the will to resist. I support the bombing now and oppose unilateral cessation of it, simply on the basis that we must now get something in order to stop the bombing. In other words, it's the one thing we can stop that the North Vietnamese want us to stop, but in turn, we must see that we get something back in return for that, and a de-escalation of the effort on both sides would be a practical basis then for negotiating the cessation of bombing. But to stop it simply and agree to never stop to bomb again as a means of getting them to begin discussions with no agreement on their part of any kind to do anything, I think would be giving up the one thing they want us to stop without getting anything back in return.
You say there's a gradation of differences here. The fact remains that two men would stop because they have no way at all of knowing what the North Vietnamese are going to do, and three of you want to continue. Now, that's a pretty sharp difference.
Well, I'd like to see it stopped if we get something back for it, but I would say the Republican differences are less than the Democratic differences on a subject such as bombing.
Mr. Bell.
Senator Baker, as the son-in-law of Senator Dirksen, the Republican leader, do you feel any dynasty pressure in your position in the Senate?
Mr. Bell, I do not. Somebody asked that the other night at Women's National Press Club and asked me how I'd respond to the in-law situation, and I've got to confess that it may be worse than you think. While Senator Dirksen is, of course, the minority leader, I have a brother-in-law who's in Congress from Virginia. But there's one thing that threads through this family and in-law relationship that I'm very proud of. By the way, my father and mother served in the Congress, too. Throughout these relationships is the common thread of what I believe to be mutual respect and the toleration of differences of opinion, the different method of approach, the different method of articulation of answers and problem-solving. As long as this good faith relationship exists, and I'm sure it will always continue to resist, I see not only no disadvantage involved, but I see a possible real advantage involved in the matter of communications.
Senator, do you find yourself in agreement with Senator Dirksen on his general support of President Johnson's course in Vietnam, aside from the bombing or particular things?
Mr. Bell, let me say that I will not now, nor will I ever, I think, try to speak Senator Dirksen's position. I think he adequately qualified to do that for himself.
Well, I think he's made rather clear that he supports the president.
The full ramifications of the support that the minority leader has given to this administration in this respect, I think, is clear. And I'll add my comments to it in this manner. I think all of us abhor war and conflict. But I also feel that notwithstanding the impatience with the inconclusive nature of this conflict, that the American people, by and large, admire and respect the stance of this nation and the considerable courage and the considerable wisdom that's gone with the effort to stop communist aggression without escalation into all-out conflict. With that, I agree.
Mr. Broder.
Senator Brooke, a year ago about this time, we had a bombing pause, and there was no response from the enemy in Vietnam. What reason is there, do you think, to believe that there would be a different reaction from them if we followed your advice and stopped bombing again?
Well, Mr. Broder, the circumstances have changed radically since a year ago when, as you stated the fact, we did not get any favorable response from the Vietnamese in the North. But on the other hand, I think now we have proven decisively that we have won the ground war in Vietnam. I think there's no doubt that we've won the military war in Vietnam. And I think now that we could expect that if there were cessation of the bombing, that we might get them, that we would get them, should I say, and I will say, that we would get them to come to the peace table and negotiate for peace. Now let me add this to it. I don't think we should have cessation for a time definite. I don't think we should say 30 days, 60 days, or a week or a day for that matter. I think we ought to put no time on it at all. We ought to cease bombing without giving any commitment as to what we would do pending what they might do in return. And I think to give them a reasonable time, and we would make that determination, we would have our recognizance continuing, we would have our system so that we would know exactly what they're doing in North Vietnam, where they're building up troops. I don't think that the risk is very great, frankly. And I think if we do this, that we are apt to bring about peace. Now, we may not have an armistice such as we've known before. No one may ever meet, sit down at the table and sign an agreement. But they might just stop fighting and go on to the hills. They know that we cannot be driven out of Vietnam. They know that we're not going to act like the French. We're not going to voluntarily leave Vietnam. And I think that then our problem will be pacification, which we can handle with a cutback of troops, because we've been losing too many American lives. We've lost over 6,000 American lives already in Vietnam, over 300,000 casualties. The war is costing us $2 billion a month and ever escalating. The economy is being injured, and all the young men in college today and not in college, on and off the campuses, are concerned as to whether they're going to be called up for the draft.
Senator, what consequences do you see if your advice is not followed and the war goes on in the direction in which it's now headed?
Well, I think that we're going to just keep going as we have been going for a long period of time. The President, in his State of the Union address the other night, indicated that he did not favor escalation, and I certainly would agree with that. So apparently he's not going to bomb Haiphong, and he's not going to mine the ports. He probably is just going to keep up with this limited bombings in the north. And if we continue to do this, this could go on 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and the number of casualties will be ever increasing, and we'll never get out of Vietnam.
Mrs. Dickerson.
Senator Hansen, there was a very contentious issue in your home state of Wyoming that is equally contentious here in Washington, namely the right to work law. And when you were governor, you signed such a law, but at the time, I understand you called out the National Guard to prevent any mishap. Well, if that matter came up again in Congress, and as you know, the Senate has twice refused to consider it, would you be for repealing the law that bans the union shop, the 14B of the Taft-Hartley law, or would you be against it?
Let me say, Ms. Dickerson, first of all, the situation with regard to the National Guard in Wyoming has been very much misunderstood. It was not my intention ever to have anyone aware that the Guard was even involved. I simply asked the Adjutant General of Wyoming to have some guardsmen stand by if need be in order to maintain the dignity and the decorum that I felt should prevail in both the House and the Senate.
But it was a controversial issue.
It was, yeah. Only one or two of the legislators, and they only, after all the debate was over, were aware that there were any guardsmen in the Capitol. I did not know that they were going to be there. The Speaker of the House had asked that they be called out. I do favor 14B. I would vote to retain 14B.
Are you going to suggest that this become a part of the Republican platform? I understand there will be a so-called Republican State of the Union message this next week. Would you suggest that as being an important part of it?
Well, I think that the distinguished minority leader of the Senate has certainly spelled out his position in that regard. I support him entirely in this issue. I don't suspect that I will be making too many suggestions at this time to the Republicans.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator Hatfield, you and several other Republicans have said that we ought to stop the bombing because it doesn't seem to be doing any good. Why are the North Vietnamese howling so if it isn't doing any good? And if it isn't doing any good, what difference does it make if it continues?
This is the very question I have asked, and that is that we have had this bombing now for quite some time, and when you consider that only about 15% of their total gross national output is in an industrial category, it's not as if we were bombing a European city or a European country. This is a rural agricultural area, and I cannot see where our bombing has had any great effect. Of course, any bombing at all is going to be looked upon by any government as an invasion of its sovereignty. And as a government of North Vietnam, they will protest in order to protect their people. This has political significance to them. I do not think it has great military significance because they have kept the supplies coming, and they've kept the infiltration going. In fact, they have increased it, as our bombing has increased. And so I, therefore, have asked the question, is it worth all of the loss that we have suffered by continuing the bombing? Now, you're trying to isolate today only one part of the total Vietnamese problem, and that is the bombing. I think we must consider that there are the diplomatic maneuvers, the diplomatic front that we must mobilize, and on a relentless drive, move to present this to the Asian people, to the Asian countries. I believe that President Marcos of the Philippines was very accurate when he said that eventually Asian answers must be found for Asian problems. I would like to see a coordination between the diplomatic and the military, see us de-Americanize the military front, so that when we have an all-Asian conference, as Chuck Percy, Senator Percy has suggested, and others, It would be an Asian military issue and not an American
Senator
one that
Hatfield,
they would be settling.
One of your leading Republicans, Ambassador Lodge, is right there on the ground and has been on the ground for a long time, and he believes the bombing has done a great deal of good and continues to do a great deal of good. And recently he said, when you suspend, the people who pay for it is the American soldier. He gets killed or he gets wounded. Now, why would you, who are off here, want to make a decision of that kind when one of your own leading Republicans on the ground wants to continue the bombing?
Because I think that Senator Lodge, of course, expresses a viewpoint, but there are other viewpoints as well from men who have been on the ground and who have made evaluations. We have no consensus of what should be done or should not be done on the military front, even amongst the generals. I think General Gavin, General Ridgway, are good examples of where there is actual diversion of opinion even amongst the generals. So I think you're quoting Senator Lodge in itself does not mean that we are precluded from this side of the ocean
of
making evaluations.
Aren't they all ex-generals who fought the last war? They're not fighting this war, are they?
Pardon me?
Gavin and Ridgway are all ex-generals who fought the last war, aren't they?
These are knowledgeable generals who have a great record of achievement, and I think their voice and their opinions are worthy of respect.
Knowledgeable about Vietnam?
I think they are very knowledgeable about Vietnam.
Mr. Bell.
Senator Percy, Governor George Wallace of Alabama said the other day that he's probably going to run for president, but not as a white backlash candidate. He says there isn't any white backlash. Do you agree with the governor's assessment of the political situation?
Well, I think the white backlash is vastly overrated. And I think there is protest by both Negroes and whites at lack of progress in some areas. But I think that anyone in a diverse state who ran on a backlash issue would be defeated and should deserve to be defeated, and I can't imagine him running not as a backlash candidate.
You don't think it'll be an issue in 1968?
I would hope not. I would hope we would get down to the solution of the problems, the human problems that cause such dissatisfaction, the problems that to make our urban areas more habitable, better places in which to live and work. And we would not so much look at it as a color problem as at a real problem to help all Americans enjoy the equality of opportunity in housing and jobs and education that they deserve to have.
Senator, can you foresee any circumstances under which you might become Illinois' favorite son candidate for the Republican presidential nomination in 68?
No, I cannot. If we have a favored son, I should think it would be Everett McKinley Dirksen. But I cannot see that I would be involved in it. I have no responsibility other than to be a good senator for the next 6 years.
Well, would you favor an uninstructed delegation then from Illinois?
I think right now the delegation could not be instructed. It's not clear enough. You can't support a non-candidate, and we have no candidates for the Republican nomination.
Well, a few
of us
mentioned, of course.
Mr. Broder.
Senator Baker, there's been considerable speculation that if Governor Wallace ran as a third-party candidate in 1968, he might cost the Republicans the opportunity to carry some southern states which would otherwise look to the Republican Party because they are dissatisfied with President Johnson. How much appeal would Governor Wallace have in Tennessee?
Mr. Broder, I think very little, very frankly. I have no disrespect for Governor Wallace. I've never met Governor Wallace. But I think our own race for the United States Senate in 1964 and 1966 display that backlash or racial concern is not an issue by either party in the state of Tennessee. I recall in 64 I ran for the Senate, the United States Senate, and was defeated for the 2 years remaining of Senator Kefauver's term. At that time, we received about 1% of the Negro vote, I'm told. In 1966, we now have a Republican vice chairman who is Negro. We have a splendid organization that is without demarcation of color line, and we obtain something between 15% and 20%, I'm told, of the Negro vote. To make a long story short, as far as Tennessee is concerned, I'm sure that our growth in Republicanism has no relationship to racial concerns.
Senator, what is your position on open occupancy housing, and what, if any, programs are you committed to that would be specifically designed to help urban Negroes with their problems?
Mr. Broder, I have stated in the campaign that I would have opposed Title IV of the 1966 bill. However, I also stated that I believe every candidate in good conscience should be dedicated to the proposition of equality of opportunity in housing and everything else. It's a matter of technique and approach. I think the real problem is the housing, not the open housing. And I'm much intrigued with the proposal that Senator Percy is about to make, I understand, for the acceleration of housing opportunity and individual ownership. This is the answer to both urban housing problems and rural housing problems, and there are some of both.
Mrs. Dickerson.
Senator Brooke, you are for open housing. Is this another one of the big differences between you and your colleague, Senator Baker, who said that he would oppose it?
I wouldn't classify it as a big difference, Mrs. Dickerson, but you're correct. I am for open housing, and I would have voted for it had I been in the 89th Congress, and if it is proposed in the 90th Congress, I intend to vote favorably upon it.
Senator Brooke, how do you resolve this problem then? Because many, many Negro groups feel that this is the crux of what they're trying to get at this point. And doesn't it sort of send them away from the Republican Party if the people such as Senator Baker and the Senate leadership of the Republican Party opposes this and fought against it vigorously and indeed defeated such a bill in the last session?
Well, I think that the Republican Party has many voices, and I think that it's good and healthy that it does. Senator Baker has expressed his. He's for housing, and he would vote against open housing, and that's his thinking on the subject, and I have great respect for him and for his thinking. I don't think, because I differ with him on the subject, that this means that the Republican Party is in trouble because we differ on the question of open housing. The Democrats have differed on it in far greater numbers than have the Republican Party. No one is going to get everything it wants from either of the two political parties. And I think that the Republican Party has much to offer to minority groups in this country as well as to majority groups. I think it will. I think that you will see some change in the Republican Party. I think that not only will the congressional...
What kind of change, Senator Brooke? A change that would make the Negroes feel more at home in the Republican Party than they have in recent years?
I think so. I think that the Republican Party is going to move toward the center. I think it's going to be more moderate than it has been in the past. I think the presidential candidate in 1968 is going to be a moderate candidate. I think that you will see that the Republican Party will voice the opinions not only of the congressional leadership, and I speak as a member of Congress, but also of the leaders in the state houses, both in the governor's mansions and in the legislatures, where we made great progress in 1966. And I think the fact that men like Percy and Hatfield and Baker and Hansen and to a degree Brooke were elected in 1966 indicates that people are looking for courageous leadership, people who give thought to the problems, people who themselves are problem solvers. This is the kind of creative republicanism I believe in, and I think that the Negro people, like other people, are going to find this attractive to them. They're going to trust us, and they're going to vote for us.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator Hansen, one of the newspapers of your state, the Wyoming Eagle, said that you were upset because some members of the press called you an ultra-conservative. How do you consider yourself?
Well, Mr. Spivak, I feel this way, that labels really do a disservice to members of the Congress, certainly to members of the Senate, to politicians generally. I think that they have been bandied around. We've seen over the last several years all sorts of labels attached to people. I would prefer to have the people of my state and of the nation as well, if they're interested, make their assessment as to where I should be categorized on the basis of my performance in the Senate. I think, as Senator Brooke has said, I too like to regard myself as a problem solver. I think I'm a realist. I think we've seen the state of Wyoming do some great things in the last 4 years during the time I've been in the governor's chair, and I don't believe that on the basis of that it's fair to call me an ultra-conservative.
Some leading members of your state, however, say that you've been trying to move the Wyoming Republican Party from the far-right position towards the center. Is there any truth in that? Have you tried to change the complexion of of your state?
Certainly, if there is credence that can be given that statement, I think it, first of all, would indicate that the assessment made by the Wyoming Eagle was an error. I do think that my approach has been to make state government responsible and responsive to the people, to the problem of to the issue of solving problems, and I say again that there have been evaluations made of my tenure as governor. One historian said I had given the most progressive message to the legislature since 1911.
Did you or did you not get support of the state GOP for most of your programs? I understand you didn't.
Well, I think I got pretty good support.
Mr. Bell.
Senator Hatfield, I'd like to ask you the same question that I asked Senator Percy. Can you foresee any possibility in which Oregon will choose you as a favorite son in 1968, or what is your situation there?
No, because, you see, we have a very unique law in our state. We have a law that requires the name of all the nationally avowed candidates or advocated candidates to appear on our primary ballot, our presidential preferential primary. And so, consequently, we will have all the major contenders.
They are pledged to the winner of that primary.
And they are, therefore, thereby
be
pledged
no
to the winner.
No possibility of the party itself taking any other action.
I see no possibility.
Unless nobody got in the primary.
But their name will be in the primary.
Will your name be in the primary?
No, it will not be in the primary.
Now, Senator, I'd like to ask you one more question. I don't believe we've had your stand on this open housing situation.
I think a lot of these ideas, which are new, generally speaking, in social areas, create a lot of fears that are really unfounded when people get involved and really get experience in these areas. I say this because Oregon has an Open Housing Act. We have proven that it can work. It has worked. And I am hopeful that for the states which have not done this, that they will explore the possibilities of adopting such acts. And if the federal Congress comes up with a bill, I shall support it based upon our successful Open Housing Act in Oregon.
Mr. Broder.
Senator Percy, you've been identified for a long time as an advocate of increased trade, particularly East-West trade. Do you think it's possible to do, as the President suggested, and expand trade with the communist bloc countries, even under the circumstances that we face in Vietnam?
Well, I was pleased that the President did raise this and make a major point of it in his State of the Union message. I think it was courageous for him to do so in the face of the conflict we have with communism in South Vietnam. I think we have to look at different shadings of communism. The Yugoslavs are quite different than the Albanians. And I think we have to also say that if they want trade with us and contact with us, what then do we want from them? And I think we can use this as a bargaining weapon to get a quieting down of the Cold War in Europe. We can reestablish a trading position and keep, I think, our ideas alive and not isolate the people of Eastern Europe. And certainly we should work toward something we very much would like to see, a de-escalation of this military buildup between the Soviet Union and ourselves on the anti-ballistic missile, which could cost us $30 to $40 billion.
Well, Senator, who speaks for the Republicans on this issue? Senator Dirksen said that, and I quote, "I swear I can't reconcile myself to the idea that we ought to trade with the very people who have marked us for slaughter and extinction."
I think it's a matter looking at it not in its absolute sense, but saying, what can we then gain through this? I am very confident that the power of our ideas will help bring greater individual freedom to Europe, which certainly, in Eastern European countries, which certainly Everett Dirksen would support. If we can bargain with them to get certain things that we want, I think that Everett Dirksen would be one of the best who could draw up a list of particulars of the things we want from our side to ensure greater security for our own people and our own country.
What would you like to get, Senator Percy? One thing.
Well, the one single thing, of course, is peace in Vietnam. This is going to scuttle our whole domestic effort here if we can't find a solution to this problem. And though we have expressed certain differences here,
excuse me,
we have
Senator,
many things in common with our panel and all Republicans.
I'll ask you to finish that later. I must interrupt here. We'll continue with this special edition of Meet the Press with our guests, the new Republican senators, after station identification.
This is Edwin Newman inviting you to the second half of our special edition of Meet the Press with the five new Republican senators.
Just before we paused, I had asked Senator Percy what quid pro quo he would like to see the United States get for an increase in trade with the communist countries of Eastern Europe. Senator?
Well, certainly I would like to see progress made in the negotiations of arms treaties. I think we simply must accelerate the pursuit of peace and de-escalate the danger of a nuclear holocaust. The biggest single question before us now is the anti-ballistic missile. If we go into it and the Russians go into it, we both put in huge sums that would be taken out of humanitarian efforts. We'll both be a stalemate and a standoff again. I think we must find ways to negotiate de-escalation, certainly banning underground testing as we have atmospheric testing, and certainly see if we can't prevent the construction on both sides of the ocean of anti-ballistic missiles that would run into multi-billion dollar programs.
Mrs. Dickerson, question for Senator Baker.
Senator, one of the most contentious issues around here and throughout the country are those school desegregation guidelines. And as you know, recently a court in New Orleans upheld them. Now, the commissioner of the Office of Education has made his study, and he's given final orders to cut off aid to, I believe it's 38 school districts in the South because they have not complied. Now, do you go along with this? Do you think that's a good idea?
Ms. Dickerson, I think it is a national purpose, and I fully agree with the purpose to bring equality of opportunity in education and otherwise. As the law is now written, the implementation of it is by administrative edict, that is, guidelines. Judge Wisdom, in his decision, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld them, and I think from a lawyer's standpoint, he's probably right.
However, from the senator's point of view from Tennessee.
All right. Now, from the senator's standpoint from Tennessee, I think this is not the only way to accomplish these purposes. I think guidelines are arbitrary. I think they're often ineffective. They are not self-executing. They don't either bring the maximum relief on the one hand or the equitable treatment on the other. I'm going to propose a tax-sharing bill before very long, and we're going to have a different method of handling involved in our bill.
Well, would you suggest then that the Republican Party take it as a stand to set aside this guideline procedure and have a different kind of a procedure? Is that what you would like to do?
No, it isn't, Mrs. Dickerson, because I say it is now the law.
Well, would you like to change the law?
And because you think something better can be done for both sides of the controversy doesn't mean you cut loose from what you've already got. So what I'd advocate now is a little patience and a little effort to do a little better for both parties to the controversy.
I see. You mentioned a tax-sharing plan. You wish to include something about the school aid in that tax-sharing plan?
Not school aid. Now, I feel really the greatest domestic crisis we have today is the threatened destruction of local effective self-government. I'm going to propose a tax-sharing plan by which a fractional share of the federal revenues will come back to the states without strings attached, except the one basic safeguard against the using of these funds for discrimination on the basis of race or otherwise. And in this context, we'll have a different way to approach the matter of so-called guidelines. It'll be a judicial determination instead of an executive one.
Well, in his State of the Union message, President Johnson said that already 70% of all the federal expenditures for social welfare are already being distributed by the states and local governments. Do you think this amount of money should be increased?
I think the figures are right. I think the president's recitation of them is right. But bear this in mind, that the federal government doesn't even approach meeting the entire needs of the local governments in social services. And some way's got to be found to get additional funds without strings attached so that the administrative, the police, the educational, and other local opportunities can be undertaken at the local level.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator Brock, some Negro leaders are trying to make a race issue of what Congress did to Adam Clayton Powell. Do you think that makes good sense?
Well, Spivak, I have stayed out of this controversy because, as you very well know, the House is the judge of its own membership, and I'm sitting in the Senate. I do regret, however, that the Republican Party took up the leadership in this battle ultimately, because it was a Democratic problem. It was a Democratic congressman. It's a Democratic Congress. And I had hoped that we would have left it to the Democrats to solve their own problems. Now, I have no facts which would enable me to make a judgment concerning the allegations made against Mr. Powell or the allegations made by Mr. Powell against other members of the Congress, and so I cannot give a judgment on that. I do have a fear that we're going to have a problem because, obviously, Mr. Powell will run for re-election in the event that he were unseated, And if he is a candidate for re-election, and I don't like to predict, but I would think that Mr. Powell would be re-elected, perhaps overwhelmingly, by his district in Harlem. And if he does that, then the same question will come back to the Congress to solve. And I think you've got to look ahead and plan for these things.
Senator, but
now,
you
I'd
ran
to see
for...
anything tied in of this nature to the civil rights movement. I think that they are distinct and they should not be considered as one.
You feel, then, that to make a race issue of that is a mistake?
I do. I think Mr. Powell must be judged on his own merits and on his own activities and his own actions, as he's judged, as I understand, as a very gifted chairman of the committee. And I think the judgment will have to be made on Mr. Powell and not on the Negro people and not on the civil rights movement.
Senator Brooke, the newspapers report that you're uncertain about how you're going to vote on the changing the Senate rules to end the filibuster. Have you made up your mind about that yet?
No, I haven't, Mr. Spivak.
Can you tell us why you haven't?
Well, I was asked, as a matter of fact, to co-sponsor the majority and three-fifths amendment, and I declined the invitation. I have assigned this matter to my research staff. I've been doing in-depth study of the issues. I certainly do not want to be classified with one group or another group of the Senate. I want to make independent judgments on issues as they are presented to the Senate. And frankly, I want to hear the debates. I sit in the Senate and listen to the debates. I don't leave when the men are debating on these important issues because I am a freshman senator and I am green and I want to learn and I want to know. And I want to know what the proponents and the opponents are saying about Rule 22, the continuity problem, the constitutional problems that have been raised. I want to be perfectly clear before I cast my vote, and I don't want my vote taken for granted.
Senator, according to a recent Gallup poll, 73% of the American people oppose a tax increase to help pay for the war in Vietnam. Are you for or against a tax increase?
Well, I certainly was disappointed that the President at this time found it necessary to recommend this 6% surcharge. I thought that his decision in October of 1966, when he brought about the suspension of the 7% tax credit, was more political than it was economic. And I had thought when he did recommend this increase in taxation that he would have at least reinstituted the 7% tax credit, because ultimately we're going to have a layoff of thousands of construction workers around the country.
Does that now mean that you're for or against the tax increase?
Well, I want to see. I want to see first where we can cut back on important domestic spending. I have a great desire to find out whether we are running the government frugally and whether we are getting dollar-for-dollar value for the money that the federal government is spending before I would vote for an increase in taxation.
Mr. Bell.
Senator Hansen, what is your position on a tax increase? Or do you believe that the budget can be brought closer to balance by cutting expenditures?
Mr. Bell, I think that the budget can be cut in two important areas. I think in the area of foreign expenditures, foreign aid, and military support, we certainly ought to take a...
Not much foreign aid left, Senator.
Well, actually, this, of course, is a matter of some controversy. The chairman of the House Committee says that the foreign aid bill of 1966, rather than about $3 billion, was in excess of $10 billion if you put together all of the expenditures going to foreign countries that he feels should properly be included in foreign aid. I think in domestic programs, too, we may make cuts. My feeling is that I will have no misgivings at all about voting whatever is necessary in order that we may best pursue our efforts successfully and quickly in Vietnam. And in that regard, if it can be demonstrated to me that this is necessary, on that basis alone, insofar as Vietnam is concerned, I will support a tax increase. But I do think that I must be shown that we cannot make cuts in the domestic program and in the foreign aid programs without a tax increase before I would go for one.
Senator, going back to the filibuster rule, which is before the Senate now, are you likely to follow the Western tradition of being for, say, two-thirds in order to cut off filibuster? This seems to be what most Western senators automatically go to protect their small states, small in population.
Well, without certainly attempting to speak for any other Western state, I would say this, that I do recognize that the smaller states have a great strength in the Senate in the present Rule 22, and I share Senator Brooks' opinion, that I would like to hear all of the arguments. I think there is much to be said for the impact that a change in this rule might have on the contention made by many that the Senate is a continuing body, and I want to hear all of the arguments. But at the present moment, I'm inclined to agree with Senator Dirksen that we should not change Rule 22.
Mr. Broder.
Senator Hatfield, you made a lot of political points last fall as a critic of the tight money policy. Would you support a tax increase if you thought it would ease that tight money problem?
I don't think that's the only alternative we have to easing the tight money policy, and I am prone to not support the tax increase because I would feel that there are ways in which we can defer expenditures without arguing their validity at this time, such as in the area of space exploration, and where we can do much more to bring the budget into balance that would not necessitate a tax increase at this time. I think one of the fundamental problems we have in this nation is to maintain a productive economy, one that produces not only job opportunities for our people, but products and goods for consumers. And if the consumers are being robbed of their earning power, which inflation is the cruelest tax of them all in this way, I think we then weaken our economy. And I think if we're going to prosecute and successfully conclude this war, we're going to have a strong economy at home, and we cannot afford further neglect of it. And therefore, I would say put the priorities where they belong and make deferments, even though it may take a little political courage to do so.
May I ask you a political question? You were one liberal Republican who supported Senator Goldwater after his nomination. Do you think that the party is ready to nominate somebody like Governor Romney who refused to support him after his nomination?
I don't think this has really any relevance to Governor Romney's candidacy in 1968. I chose to support the ticket because the nomination was made by my party. I was titular head of my party in my state. I was not on the ballot in my state. There were a lot of conditions that were different than in Michigan. I would point out, though, that in our state, we were the only state out of the 50 that in 1964 took a House of Legislature away from the Democrats and made it Republican. And I believe this was partially due to the fact that we had united Republican support for our ticket in Oregon.
Mrs. Dickerson.
Senator Percy, there was an article in the Washington Post yesterday that said that you'd spent your first week in Congress trying to establish yourself as the GOP spokesman on the problems of cities, and it further said that you intended to introduce housing legislation that would encourage the private sector to help finance the rebuilding of slums. Have you any indication that private groups such as the labor unions, foundations, and banks would be willing to leap into this kind of a program?
Well, I am certainly not the spokesman for the Republican Party on housing, but I have a campaign pledge that is years standing to find an alternate answer to the vertical slums that have been constructed under public housing for the past 20 years that have been now recognized by all authorities as great failures. So we have to find an alternate constructive proposal, and the president was almost silent on this subject of housing. I've worked with other Republican senators and talked with them in the past week about the proposals that we can make. I think it will have widespread support from labor. I think Walter Reuther is one of the most eloquent spokesmen for now finding a way for low-income families to own their own housing. And the bills that I intend to introduce, I hope, could be comparable to opening up urban housing and certain rural housing, as well as the Homestead Act of 100 years ago opened up the West.
Well, Senator Percy, it's reported that the White House turned down a similar plan within the last few months because they could find no indication of support from these private groups to which we're referring.
I've studied the private efforts in Philadelphia and Indianapolis and St. Louis, and there are pilot projects there where private industry, where local government authorities, civic groups, unions, pension funds have worked together to solve this problem. And I think the president, when he turned to the Republicans and indicated he wanted to work with them, he wants certain support for certain of his programs. And I think that we can seek and earnestly hope to have. Even if they have dropped a program and not found a way to implement it, we can find a way to implement it, and I hope it'll have support on both sides of the aisle.
It's reported that you tried to get the Republican leadership to include this proposal as part of their State of the Union message. Did you, and did they?
I have no commitment, of course, but Gerry Ford will speak for the Republican position, for all Republicans, governors, senators, and congressmen, and I would hope he would include more on his State of the Union message on housing than the President did.
Mr. Spivak.
Senator Baker, a news release from your office says, and I quote, Howard Baker thinks the people, communities, and nation must always be cast in a role of doing. He hopes to transfer that philosophy into progress in the U.S. Senate. What as a new senator do you want most to do or see done in the Senate?
Mr. Spivak, we touched on one in the form of meeting the challenge of local community government, state government, county government, and city government. There are many others. I think stream and air pollution are problems that we've talked a great deal about and done very little about at the moment that require attention immediately. I think in the question of poverty, whether it's municipal poverty in the case we try to meet with tax sharing, or human poverty in the case of urban housing, as Senator Percy has just spoken of, that there's an opportunity, there's an obligation by the Republican Party in both houses of the Congress to find the new ways and the effective ways to meet these challenges and to provide the concrete results that the nation demands, rather than an extension of the tools that we've used for the past 35 years and which are really the outgrowth of a Depression era.
Now, during your campaign, at the same time, you called for extensive cutbacks in what you called non-essential domestic programs rather than a tax increase. Now, what programs do you want to cut back on?
Well, I think Senator...
Poverty?
Senator Hatfield, a moment ago, touched on the practical solution to the economic problem of the moment. Rather than cutback, Mr. Spivak, I think now in a time of financial crisis, we're talking about the deferring of non-essential projects until we have a better economic climate. Nobody wants to deprive anyone of valid, useful welfare programs, social welfare programs, and improvements throughout this country.
What do you mean by non-essential? What kind of programs do you consider non-essential that the Democrats have tried to put over and are putting over and spending money on?
Well, I can think of these for the moment. I can think first of the President's proposal for so-called Safe Streets and Crime Bill of 1967, which provides for direct federal grants for, in effect, the operation of local police departments. Not only do I think that is non-essential and we can save some money on it, but I abhor the idea of the federal government running a local police department, and that, in effect, is what finally would evolve. I think in the case of the so-called war on poverty, that the administrative costs of it are exorbitant. There's got to be found a new way to approach these same problems and get more for our money. But let me say just this. We're worse off than I thought. Because I read just recently a speech by Senator Williams on January 12th, which makes a substantial case for the proposition that instead of a projected $9.7 billion deficit next year, if you look at it according to standard accounting practices, we're going to have an $18.7 billion deficit next year. And if that's the case, we may have the unhappy alternatives of choosing between an enormous deficit on the one hand or a tax increase on the other. And I, frankly, don't know the answers.
Well, Senator, if you cut the money that's going to be allocated to a few police departments or to all of the police departments and even cut the beautification appropriation, you're not going to get very far, are you? Are you willing to spend the $2 billion that the President has asked for poverty, or do you want to cut that, too?
I want to find different approaches to it, and if I have to, I want to cut it only if there is no other way to maintain fiscal solvency in this country.
Mr. Bell.
Senator Burke, you've been assigned to the Space Committee, and Senator Dirksen has said this is one place where he believes that money can be saved. Would you be willing to stretch out our effort to reach the moon in order to save some money now, or do you feel this is of vital importance that we get first to the moon?
Well, I certainly think that getting to the moon is important. But I think solving the problems on Earth are more important, and though I'm very excited about my assignment to the Space Committee, I certainly would not like to see it take priority over solving our domestic problems here at home.
In other words, if it came to space and poverty, say, you would be inclined to cut space and give some more to the poverty program.
I'm for people, basically, and first. primarily, and I would certainly want to give the money.
May I ask you a political question?
Certainly. Excuse me a minute, Mr. Bell. We have about 4 minutes left. Go ahead.
Okay. Would George Romney of Michigan be acceptable to you as a Republican presidential nominee?
Yes, he would, but there are others that would be also.
Would you care to name any of the others?
Oh, my colleagues here today.
You include
all
of them?
Right down the list. We have a great freshman class. Not only do I respect them and admire them, but we've begun to love each other. I've never seen such a wonderful class, and any of them could be a candidate. There's Mr. Nixon, there's Governor Chafee in Rhode Island, there's Governor Volpe, my own governor, who certainly must be considered in Massachusetts. So we won't have any lack of candidates in 1968.
Will you make a combination with some other New England states, as far as the convention is concerned, in favor of some moderate candidate, for instance?
Will I?
Well, Massachusetts, I'm talking about your state.
Well, I don't want to speak for Massachusetts. I don't know what we're going to do as yet. Certainly, if Governor Volpe wants to be a favorite son candidate, he would have my support. And we certainly would like to have New England represented whenever we've had an opportunity to have representation. I think we've done it well, and we've done the country and the world well.
Mr. Broder.
Senator Hansen, two quick questions. First, political. As a early Goldwater supporter, could you support somebody like Governor Romney who never went along with the ticket?
Yes, I could. I've said so.
How much support does he have in your state?
He has substantial support.
On the military subject, do you agree with Senator Percy that the United States ought to try to negotiate with Russia before trying to match what they apparently have started doing on the anti-ballistic missile?
Well, number one, I think that the position of the United States will best be enhanced insofar as negotiation is concerned if we negotiate from a position of strength. And because of this, I think we should keep our defenses up on ourselves strong militarily. Now, beyond that, I'm in complete accord in doing whatever we can to try to bring about a diminution of armaments.
Mrs. Dickerson.
Senator Hatfield, before you left Oregon, you said that while GOP chances of winning the presidential election in 68 were good, it would be folly for Republicans to think that just any candidate could beat President Johnson if he were to run. The question is, who could best run against President Johnson?
As I view it now, we have at least 10 candidates who could beat President Johnson in 1968.
Do you want to name any of them?
Well, there are four have been named here today, my colleagues, along with others who have been named. And I think there are others, Governor Love of Colorado, I would add, and Governor Evans of Washington.
How about Governor Romney? Some people believe that he's pushing too fast in the road toward a possible candidacy.
I believe Governor Romney is best suited to make that judgment. I think he's doing very well.
Is there any chance that the Republicans could have a convention pretty well sold up, as Senator Barry Goldwater had it 4 years ago, 2 years ago, rather?
I don't believe so. I think that Senator Goldwater started in 1960, as he told us in Chicago, his followers, that he was going to do, and he started then and worked for 4 years in developing his support. I do not know of any candidate who's been working 4 years prior to 1968.
Gentlemen and lady, 30 seconds left. Mr. Spivak.
Senator Percy, there are going to be a great many union management negotiations, wage management. Do you think, and many strikes are anticipated, do you think the time has come for new federal legislation to do something about strikes?
Yes, I do.
You have 15 seconds.
I think that we must work toward the public interest and not tie this country up, and certainly we must prevent union monopoly over all forms of transportation, as one union is attempting to do.
Thank you, Senator Percy. I have to cut you off there because our time is up. Thank you, gentlemen, for being with us today on Meet the Press. I'll tell you about next week's guest after this message.
For a printed copy of today's interview, send 10 cents in coin and a stamp, self-addressed envelope, to Merkle Press, Box 2111, Washington, D.C., 20013.
Next week on Meet the Press, our guest will be the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator J.W. Fulbright. Now, this is Edwin Newman saying goodbye for our guests, the new Republican senators, and Meet the Press.
Meet the Press has been a public affairs presentation of NBC News.